All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate.
That's right, back again.
Yep, having more fun than ever. All right, we have a really packed show for you today. And basically, it's going to be a push to get all the way through this, but it's all really, really important. At the back end of the show, we'll be listening to an interview I did with Angelo Guisado, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he specializes in government misconduct, racial justice, and immigrants' rights. And he's going to be talking about attacks on all the lawyers that are working with immigrants down along the southern border. And it's fairly heavy. It's very heavy when you hear about what's going on. So really looking forward to that. Before that, we'll be listening to a short piece from Bob Avakian called Bob Avakian Straight Up on the Revolution and the Gangs. And that's related to our opening. I'm really pleased to be opening the show up with a piece from Joe Veal from the Revolution Club, the Revolutionary Communist Party, and a former member of the Black Panther Party. I had a chance to talk with Joe about he has an article in the current issue of revcom.us. He has that on the front page there, and that article is titled To All Those Who Grieve for Nipsey Hussle and Want a Better World. And, I have to tell you, it's something I think you'll get a lot out of. I'm really looking forward to opening this up to you, and I'm not going to talk a whole lot about it because the interview itself tells a whole hell of a lot, and it's something you should really tune in close to, all right? So without any further ado, let's listen to Joe Veal. And here to talk about Nipsey Hussle and what happened to him is the author of that article, Joe Veal. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Let's jump into it because there's a whole lot we have to talk about. You know, when you think about it, and I know a lot of people are wondering around this, you know, there's been stories put out about what killed Nipsey Hussle. You answered that with something I think a lot of people wouldn't think automatically to go to. In the beginning of your article, you talked about what actually killed Nipsey. Let's talk about that.
The system that killed him. The system, this capitalist imperialist system, this dog-eat-dog system, and all the morals and the values, the backstabbing, throat-cutting values and morals and ethos that goes with this system is what, when you get down to it, is what killed Nipsey, irrespective of who pulled the actual trigger. Whoever they were acting as part of and carrying out, you know, the values and morals. And so what I've just spoken of, the system.
Well, let's talk about that more because here's the situation. I mean, I think it's really important what you're saying about this, but it's also, you know, look, this is the way that a lot of people live, right? I mean, they're actually people, one, choose it, but in a sense, they think they choose this kind of life. But at the same time, actually what's going on is they're being forced to live that. And you argue that people actually don't have to settle for that. Let's talk about that just to set a context for this.
Yeah, because there's a whole way, there's a whole other like way that we can live, that the, you know, society and the world can be through revolution. This system is what it is. It can't be reformed. Humanity is faced with two choices. Either we go along and live with the shit that this system like does and forces people to do, or we make revolution to overthrow this system and bring about a whole different kind of system, a whole new system. A new socialist republic in North America, which is the constitution for a whole new system that's been authored by Bob Avakian, who's the leader of the revolution and the person who has brought forth a whole new framework for revolution and for communism, for human emancipation. He's done something that hasn't been done since Karl Marx did what he did. And he's the leader, you know, the strategic as well as the political leader of the revolution today.
Now tell me this though, because as you're talking about that, I kept thinking, all right, that's really, it's important, it's true. There's also though, you know, you have somebody, you know, people will be looking at this and they'll be saying, well, look, Nipsey was living his kind of way. He was living in a way that he cared for people and he had all kinds of ideas about how they can get out of the trap that they're born into, that they're really born into. I mean, he had everything you can think of in terms of, you know, black capitalism, you know, entrepreneurialism, all these kinds of things, right? Now you say that this isn't enough. That let's talk about that because a lot of people, I don't think people understand that when you're talking about this kind of stuff, there's really all these things that look like gateways and ways that you can actually function within the system and survive or make things better. People believe that, and you argue very fiercely, I think, against that.
Yeah, you know, even I would put it a little differently than that. the question that we are faced with is what path or what roadway will lead to overcoming and overthrowing the oppressor, and what road will lead you right back into the killing embrace, the real living horror of this system, no matter how good your intentions are, you know. And Nipsey Hussle, you know, this should be like straight up, you know. You know, he wanted to, you know, he was aspiring to be, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, you know, tech billionaires. And that's how he thought he can be able like to help his people, is by becoming a millionaire or a billionaire. And, you know, investing into the, as I said in the article, in the new frontiers of electronics and computer science. You know, which can only mean today, under the command of the global capitalist system, it can only be, and it is, you know, you're feeding off like a parasite off of the great mass of the world, humanity, no matter what your intention is, because this is the deal. Capitalism depends on the exploitation of the masses of people here and around the world, exploiting people, including children as young as 4 years old. Just take for an example, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, you got people working in the mines digging for minerals like coltan and cobalt. These are the minerals that are shipped into sweatshops in China and other places where other exploited people put them into smartphones, laptops, computers, electronic cars that are then sold and bringing in hundreds of millions in profit. And meanwhile, the very people, including the children, have their lives stolen from them. And other people in China are worked like slaves. So we have like a city, yes, people like that, the Zuckerbergs and the Musks that, you know, Nipsey was aspiring like to be, have great wealth, while the people worldwide are left in conditions without running waters or toilets, unable to even feed themselves, and dying from diarrhea, cholera, malnourishment, starvation, AIDS, and malaria. And here we living in a situation today where you got the whip of hunger and disease that keeps people trapped in these relations. It's like the whipping machine during slavery times. Only now the whip that takes chunks of flesh out of people's body is the whip of starvation, or the whip of watching your children shrivel up and die. That's this global system of capitalism and imperialism. It can't do anything other than that. And it must be like overthrown, and it can be like overthrown. We have a strategy and a plan like for that, how we can win. People need to get their hands on this strategy that's been developed by the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party. People need to get their hands on that. When I say that Bob Avakian, that we never had a leader like him since Karl Marx, that we have something really like precious that can lead like this revolution. We have the leadership that's really like precious. And people need to see, and you, if you get your hands on this film, why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution by Bob Avakian, you'll see what I'm talking about. So you need to go to revcom.us and get your hands on that and watch that, and let's talk further and, you know, begin to get involved into the real solutions. The real solution to, you know, the horror and the oppression that people like face every day under this damn system.
Well, let me ask you this. It's really important what you're saying. And at the same time, I keep thinking about this too, because there's a point that I think you've made either in your article or talking at other times when we've spoken together. You've made this point about the very morality of this system. You know, it's not like this system is just sort of out there and operating. You know, it's just like a structure that people can plug into and it doesn't have any meaning. There's a morality of the system, which is actually a death trap for the people to get into it and for the people who have to live under it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you know, I remember, I think that's very important. I was reflecting myself on something that, you know, and thinking about this interview that, you know, that I heard Nipsey Hussle give. And I was thinking about it, you know, where he talked about, he recognized it on one level, when, you know, because he talked about, you know, when he was, you know, banging and stuff, you know, how you go into another hood to shoot it up. And you know, and so you're looking for, you know, who you're going to get, And he talked about, you know, you go past, you know, square looking people, you know, you just keep like going and stuff. You let them go. And you pass, you know, you pass by somebody from another race and you let them go. Then you look for someone else. Then you, you know, you look for someone who is rolling through the hood that you're in the same way that you roll through your hood. Young, cocky, you know, defiant, you know, you fearless. Don't fear nothing, don't fear like nobody. But that's who you're looking for. That's the one you want to get. That's the one you want to shoot. The one that looks just like you. And this reflects how the system conditions you and shapes you to carry out its own work, eliminating, getting you to participate in eliminating whole sections of people that it can no longer profitably exploit in order, you know, to make profits. Because you have a whole section of youth these days who this system like looks at and figures it can't exploit them and make profits from them like they used to be able to off of their grandmothers or their parents before them. You know, either out in the cotton fields or in, you know, in factories where they was the last hired and first fired. While on the one hand, you have the police that, you know, kill thousands over the decades. They've been killing thousands a year, killing people, murdering people. Rarely ever, if ever, any of them like go to jail like Ford and stuff. Well, you have that like going on. You have a situation where that like is going on. And then you have like a situation where they, through the workings of the system, where they have no use, how they can use and exploit and make profits off of like people, just left them out on the streets with like nothing. And so, you know, and people still going to try to find a way to make their mark, to make their way like in the world. And you end up, you know, you out on the corner or whatever. You can end up claiming this corner. You don't own it or whatever. You out here and stuff. Somebody like comes through there, disrespect you or whatever, you know, or shoot you. Then you have to go out there and retaliate and do like the same thing in order to have and try to be somebody and have like some respect on the system's terms. You still, you know, you still within the, caught up in the trap, in the framework of this system. Again, you know, it's like what BA says, basics. Now, BA says, there's an appeal that he like made that speaks to this here. He said, here I'm speaking to not only to prisoners, but those whose lives, whose life is lived on the desperate edge. Whether or not they find some work, to those without work or even home. To all those the system and its enforcers treat as so much human waste material. Raise your sights above the degradation and madness, the muck and demoralization, above the individual battle to survive and to be somebody on the terms of the imperialists, of fouler, more monstrous criminals than mythology has ever invented or jails ever held. Become a part of the human saviors of humanity, the grave diggers of this system's and the bearers of the future communist society. And this, he goes on to say, is not just talk or an attempt to make poetry here. There are great tasks to be fulfilled, great struggles to be carried out, and yes, great sacrifices to be made to accomplish all of this. But there is a world to save and to win. And in the process, those the system has counted as nothing can count for a great deal. They represent a great reserve force that must become an active force for the proletarian revolution. And if we're going to like be out here putting our life on the line and dying for something, let it be about like this. Or let it be about bringing about a whole new society and a whole new world.
Let me ask you this, your own experience, you know, because you're talking about Nipsey Hussle, and you're talking about other people in the neighborhoods. You know, people who are dealing with, in a certain sense, they're dealing with the cards they were dealt with, and they're trying to do this, or they're trying to get establish themselves like he was, is looking at a way to work within the system to get it done, or to stepping outside of it. You had some experience around that I think it'd be important for people to understand, you know, what goes on there, and then how do you break out of it?
People struggle with me. That's how I broke out of it. I began like to see there's another way, you know.
Well, when you say people struggled with you, what were they struggling with you about? What were you doing? What was happening?
I was taken from people. You know, that's what I was doing. I was out there on the street. I was taken like from others. I was jacking people like from their shit, you know. That's what I would do, you know. I would stick a gun in people's face and say, give me your money or your life. Then I saw people, you know, who was out there fighting for revolution and fighting for, you know, they should make revolution and create a different society that serves the people, you know, that puts the people, the interests of the people like first and not like individual, you know, your own individual survival like first and stuff. And there's people in the Black Panther Party back then that was struggling with me and arguing with me like in that way and stuff. And it was through that process that I began to change. That to see that not only, you know, that there's another way that the world can be like organized through a real revolution, even though we didn't really have the strategy, the plan to really take the revolution all the way back then, but they were right. That the only way to end the oppression of Black people, the system, the capitalist system has to be overthrown. But like I said, back then, we didn't have the strategy, the leadership, and the science to do that. Well, we got that now. We got that more than we ever like had it. Before, with, you know, Revolutionary Communist Party, the Revolution Club, and with Bob Avakian. What we don't, like, have, and what we need, is the masses of people who begin to take up the strategy for beginning to work for a revolution, beginning to work right now. That's what we are doing. We're organizing a tour. We have a revolution tour that's going around the country. We're organizing people into the revolution right now, hastening the time when we really can go all out against this system and defeat its instruments of violence, its instruments, its police forces, its courts, and, you know, to break them apart, to dismantle them, to overthrow like this system, and to bring about a new system with new instruments that serves the interests of the revolution and serves the interests of the people. That outlook of looking out for myself, and no matter, like, I have to get some respect on the terms of this system, all that does is lead you right back into the system. You never get out of it. You never get out of his thinking. You never get out of, like, acting in the ways that are dictated, you know, by the rules of this system, of looking out for number one, of dog eat dog, a cutthroat, or whatever, to get mine for my group, for my people in relationship to other like people and stuff. You're always in competition, and whoever is the strongest or whoever is the most ruthless is the one that wins out and stuff. But with that outlook, you can never like get out of this system. And that's what like led me, that's how I began like to get out, because it takes a scientific understanding to see, you know, how you are being played by the system once you adopt, you know, the outlook of this system. But there's an outlook that corresponds to a whole different way that society through revolution can be organized. There's an outlook that goes with that. The outlook of emancipating humanity and putting humanity first. Fighting like for that and making that as strong as possible and pushing that way out there today as far as we can to quicken and to organize people into that. Again, getting with the revolution tour, the organizing tour that's going around the country like right now, supporting that, contributing to that, becoming part of that and working for that. That's how we're gonna get people like out of the madness of just, you know, being killing each other or being like played and just going along like with the system and thinking that this is the only way, which is bull crap. The only way that society can be organized. It's the only way and it's the best way. That's what they got us like thinking, because revolution is not out here strong enough to show people in reality that there's a whole different like way that we can be. And we have the leadership to bring that about, but we got to get with it and make it real. And make it strong.
Now, one thing, yeah, that's really important. And I think one of the things that you actually spoke about in your piece that sort of was connected up with this was actually talking about, you know, look, there's a thing that happens here where you talked about Nipsey and the way that, and other people in the neighborhood, other people in neighborhoods just like that all across the country. You know, there's this whole situation of how are you going to do this? What are you going to do? And, you know, a lot of times, like with him, He was trying all kinds of different things. And, you know, we've seen this a million times over, but it's really important for people to understand what's actually going on with this. When people start talking about it, and it was disgusting when the police came in that night and said, oh, well, he wanted to meet with us. We want to meet with you. And it's not like you're going to go out and you're going to say, oh, that means Nipsey Hussle was an ass. But it does mean that there's something going on here that people need to understand, because a whole lot of people look at, if we can just find somebody who's sympathetic within the system, if we can just find some way to sort of argue back and forth with the police, that sets up a very dangerous precedent for people.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's very important that, you know, people want to, you know, people strive to, you know, they aspire to get out of the trap of just like killing, you know, like each other and stuff, getting like played and getting pitted against each other and stuff. People do strive, and they strive, and they bring about truce. Anytime they bring about like gangs, that's what the people is trying to like do, and they're trying to, you know, bring forward something like different, a different way to relate like with each other and stuff. But, you know, the entrepreneur, the black capitalism stuff, like I was saying, that just leads you right back into the system, and it just keeps the system like going. It's illusionary. It's illusionary because most people, the whole overwhelming majority, get chewed up and spit out by like the system, and the few that's able like to slip through and become like Zuckerberg or Musk, you know, you become part of the machinery, you become part of the system that is chewing up those millions and billions of people and spitting them out. Like those little kids over there, like in the Congo, or, you know, people in China, or, you know, those women and girls over there in Bangladesh that make all our clothes. And then, I mean, other like people around the world. So trying to get out of that trap, there's a way to get out of it, and there's a way that you end up right back in it. And the black capitalism, it just leads you right back into, you never get out of the system. At best, you can become a part. Maybe, you know, some group that wasn't part of amassing wealth at the expense of the world's great majority of humanity get included within that. You get to become like a parasite into this parasitical-like system. And then the police, it should be like clear. They enforce all this. Like I was saying like earlier, they kill thousands of people every year. Like B.A. said, the role of the police is not to serve and protect the people. The role of the police is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, that enforces these relations of poverty, of exploitation, of misery, of one group being pitted against the other. That's the role like of the police. We all like know, you know, that they especially, disproportionately, they kill off black, Latino, and Native American people and every like year, you know? And so come on, people. We know what they do. We know they incite the gangs to go after each other and stir up to keep this going and have an excuse to bring the hammer down on people. The role of these police is not to serve and protect the people, and it never can be, no matter what they tell you.
All right, one last question, man. One last question. It runs through everything you've been talking about. All the things that you're talking about posit a certain path. They posit a certain goal. They actually talk about a certain goal. So what would you say to somebody? I mean, the people that you're talking about, the people that you knew back when you were a kid, the people that you see today, the people from the Nipsey Hussles to the people that are in the gangs, to the people that are living or trying to look for some way to work and just squeak their way through things. What would you say to people about what's actually going to free humanity? One, is it, you know, a lot of people, if you said, look, we're about freeing humanity. People actually, they may think, well, wait, what does that mean? You know, we're free, we're this, whatever this, that. But actually freeing humanity from all of the horror that actually is plaguing the planet right now. Because you are, you know, some of the stuff you were referring to before, including the fact that, look, it's not even a given. And frankly, there's a tremendous danger that the planet may not even be able to survive.
Right.
What's being done to it.
Right.
And then the people all over the world, and, you know, I've seen this in places that I've gone to, you know, where a woman was pecking at the ground trying to get little grains of wheat that had fallen off when they were being hauled into a ship, and she's trying to gather it together so she can feed her kid, or another person, another woman who tried to make it from a desert in Ethiopia, and she had five or six kids, and her mother, and she had to get to the capital. But she couldn't do it with all the people. She had to determine how many people she would have to leave behind, because if she brought them all, they would die. You have this kind of system. Let's talk about this. Let's just trip out a little. Let's just talk about this. What do you say will actually free humanity from all this horror?
Revolution. Nothing less, you know. We got to overthrow it. System can't be reformed. We have to overthrow this system, and it can be overthrown. But you have to have a scientific approach. You have to have a leadership. You have to have the strategy that can lead like this. You have to have a leader and leadership, and we have that. And that's what and people need to get with that. You know, again, why we need an actual revolution and how we really can make revolution. At revcom.us, speech, a talk by Bob Avakian. You need to get their hands on that, and people need to get with that, with this leadership. You know, we need a whole different setup, a whole different system where the economy is geared not to make a few people rich, but to uproot and overcome all exploitation and oppression all over the world. To meet the material needs of society and the people who make it up, and to take care of the environment for future generations. We need a system where everything, the schools, the culture, everything, does not encourage and reinforce all the dog-eat-dog reality, but gives backing to the real humanity that people aspire to, but constantly find themselves up against the system when they try to live that way. We need to make revolution in this country as our part in getting to that world. That is what the revolution is fighting for. That's what we're doing on the revolution tour. And the choice is this, again, either we live with all this horror, with this madness, or we make revolution. Those are the two choices.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. That was Joe Veal. Joe's from the Revolution Club and the Revolutionary Communist Party. And you can read his whole article on revcom.us. And I really suggest that you check out the film of Bob Avakian's speech, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, which he referred to in this talk. But I really think I really, really, really highly recommend that you go and dig into that. It's one of the most important things out there in the world today in terms of what's going to happen to the planet, what's going to happen to humanity, and what can be done to change this and what it's going to take to change this. And I think it's really, really important for people to check this out. And you can access that at revcom.us as well as on my website. There's some links to that as well. All right, now we're going to listen to a short excerpt from that film, and we'll be right back. So check this out.
It has been raised that when How We Can Win insists that the authority people look to cannot be those who turn people against each other when they need to be uniting for this revolution, it is talking about gangs, among others. Well, in making this revolution, we are not going out to make an enemy out of the gangs. We are working to win people to revolution and to build up the forces for this revolution, in line with what is concentrated in the points of attention for the revolution, to put an end to everything that enslaves and degrades people, including all the conditions that have led to the creation of gangs in the first place, and the situation where so many of our youth are fighting and killing each other, and let everyone decide where they stand in relation to this revolution that we are working for. But we need to struggle hard against the way of thinking that says it's everybody for themselves and you got to do what you got to do to get over on everybody else and get big bank and have lots of property, including turning women into property. All of this is just an imitation of the outlook of the oppressor, and it is a big part of what has kept masses of people oppressed and degraded for so long. Once again, all played out, calls this shit out. I got my mind on my money and my money on my mind. That craziness about being like Scarface, acting without a trace of humanity, plundering and violating without remorse, killing and dying for no good purpose. Give it up, it's
all played out.
In thinking about people who've gotten into the life, often from a very early age, I'm reminded of the lines in a song from back in the day by the R&B group The Whispers. Seems like I gotta do wrong, gotta do wrong, gotta do wrong before they notice me. Well, f*** they. To invoke a statement by Frederick Douglass from the days of slavery that very well captures the truth today, they are guilty of crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. For revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. All this relates to what I said in an appeal to those the system has cast off. Raise your sights above the degradation and madness, above the individual battle to survive and to be somebody on the terms of the imperialists, of fouler, more monstrous criminals than mythology has ever invented or jails ever held. Become a part of the human saviors of humanity, the grave diggers of this system, and the bearers of the future communist society. In opposition to those who mislead the people, the authority of the revolution and its leadership can be extended and strengthened as it brings to light through scientific analysis what is really going on in all the major events in society and the world, and where the fundamental interests of the masses of humanity actually lie, and as it mobilizes increasing numbers of people to fight for those fundamental interests. But building up this revolutionary authority will not happen automatically. It too must be consistently worked for and vigorously fought for as a concrete goal, an important part of carrying out the three prepares. You go out and you talk to people about revolution, and they say they don't want to hear that. You tell them to quit opening their mouth and letting the oppressor come out of it. This basic guideline is set forth in How We Can Win. We need to approach everything, evaluate every political program and every organized force in society, every kind of culture, values, and ways of treating people according to how it relates to the revolution we need. A revolution to do what? To end all oppression. Here again is the importance of the points of attention for the revolution and winning more and more people to uphold, live by, and fight for this in building the revolution we need to end all oppression. We need to combine a firmness of principle and unwavering grip on the strategic goal of revolution with a broadness of mind and generosity of spirit. We need to work with many different kinds of people in building resistance against the crimes of the system, while keeping our eye clearly on the prize of revolution and struggling in a good way to win people from all parts of society to active involvement in, positive support for, or at least friendly neutrality towards this revolution. How We Can Win puts it in basic terms: we should unite with people whenever we can and struggle with them whenever we need to advance the revolution. And it gives a sense of the breadth of people that should be involved in this revolution. People in the inner cities and in the prisons, students, scholars, artists, lawyers and other professionals, youth in the suburbs and rural areas, people in all parts of society need to know about this and seriously take it up.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a new synthesis of communism, the new communism. And this was Bob Avakian, Straight Up on the Revolution and the Gangs. And it's an excerpt from a talk that BA gave last year, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And we are really pushing along right now. And I want to, before we get actually any further into things, I want you to hear this piece that I've played a little while back, but I haven't played it for a long time. And it's really timely, okay? It's Sonny Meadows with Just Like Germany Before the War.
Ein, zwei, drei. Sphere. Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before the war. The balance of power shifted when the people cast their vote. Our lining up the victims, the villains, and the scapegoats. And we're all singing hallelujah, death penalty's been restored. Just like in Germany, just before the war. We used to feed the hungry, care for the disabled and the poor. To care about civil rights, but we don't give a damn anymore. We used to harbor the wretched refuse, but now we bar the door. Just like in Germany, just before the war.
Center for Constitutional Rights reports outrageous harassment, intimidation, and physical abuse of lawyers and human rights activists doing essential work on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border at a time when the Trump-Pence regime is violently attacking migrants, denying people the right to apply for asylum, demonizing and terrorizing immigrants, and tearing children, even babies, from their parents. These attacks on legal professionals and human rights activists must end, and this fascist regime has to be driven from power by mass protests in the streets. And joining us to talk about all this now is Angelo Guisado, who is from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Angelo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Let's jump into this. Give us a sense of what's happening, an overview of the situation that's facing lawyers working with immigrants on both sides of the border these days.
The United States has for 3 or 4 years impeded access to the asylum process. I like to call it death by a thousand cuts. Although President Trump recently instituted something called the asylum ban, the reality is that individuals have had difficulty accessing the asylum process since the Obama administration. One of the cases that I work on, in addition to the asylum ban, is called Al Otro Lado v. Nielsen. And that deals specifically with the U.S. government's refusal to allow people to access asylum at the ports of entry. So people who make the extremely harrowing, dangerous journey, hundreds of miles, thousands of miles, just to get to the border only to be turned away because the United States doesn't feel like it. And that's unlawful, and that's something that we're seeing border-wide, and it's something that immigration lawyers and advocates are rightfully fighting in the courts and on the ground.
You know, actually, I was reading up a little bit on that. Is it Al Otro Lado?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, in terms of the harassment that's hitting them, it's like, let's talk about, first of all, give people a sense of what that group is and what kind of harassment is actually coming down on the lawyers working there.
Of course. So Al Otro Lado was originally started by three women lawyers who quit their jobs, moved everything to address the incredible humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. And among other things, what they do is they assist individuals who are about to enter a mass detention system, advising those people who have valid asylum claims what they should expect. And the government, over the past couple of years, as El Otro Lado has gained sort of fame and prominence for their rightful sacrifice and work and just utter tirelessness against an inhumane system, the government's decided to retaliate against them in different ways. So the individuals often find themselves detained for no reason, stopped at checkpoints, investigated. One of our clients from El Otro Lado ended up on a secret government dossier. It's very clear that the government's retaliating against our clients for helping migrants in need of access to the asylum process, and that's pretty clear retaliation.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about the retaliation, because I was really kind of, that was sort of a mind blower in a sense of how out there it is, the fact that dossiers were created by the U.S. government against activists, lawyers, and journalists for all the stuff along the southern border between U.S. and Mexico and all the people working there, that all the people that were actually coming up and working to help, to intercede between this fascistic regime and what's happening to the immigrants, you know, it's very, very heavy that this kind of thing, these kinds of dossiers and stuff were actually put out there and targeting people.
I referenced earlier that the United States is trying to block access to the immigration process through death by a thousand cuts. And I actually view this as one large slice. So as the government has in previous years used threats, intimidation, coercive tactics to impede access to asylum, this is one of them. The government understands that El Otro Lado is doing very vital work to try and assist individuals who often aren't sophisticated enough to understand our very complex immigration and mass detention system. And the government, I believe, knows that if it can retaliate against lawyers, activists, and organizers, then it can throw more sand in the gears of the asylum process itself. And so in that way, this is actually just part and parcel of the Trump administration's larger aim to make the country wider and less immigrant.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing, too, is that you had mentioned or insinuated that the clients themselves were also being targeted. What happened to them in relation to this?
Well, each of them has been detained. There have been alerts placed on their visas. Obviously, they are being surveilled. It's unclear the extent to which they're being surveilled. I mean, having your name come up in a government dossier is pretty intimidating to me. But El Otro Lado is a cross-border organization that takes cases in California in immigration court and has a binational presence. And so crossing the border to represent their clients is extremely vital to facilitating their goals and completing their mission of providing robust representation to this really crazy immigration system that we have. And so to the extent that the government can impede them from crossing the border, they really stop and really bring their work to a halt.
You know, I kept thinking of this, and because the next question I'm going to ask you has something to do with that even more. I think it's the sort of way that these things, well, one, going back on these dossiers that you talked about before, these are not only created for the local officials and for the people that are running roughshod over the lawyers. I think what I read in a report on this is that it also goes out into various agencies, various government agencies, to share these dossiers, and then where it goes from there is kind of anybody's guess.
This is nothing new from the United States government. I mean, currently the government's monitoring so-called black identity extremists, which is nothing but Black Lives Matter activists, organizers, who are trying to fight for civil and human rights in the country. Going back to a long history of surveillance and retaliatory action taken against left-wing organizers, look at COINTELPRO, look at the surveillance over the Chicano movement, the Young Lords. This is right within the government's bailiwick, and to the extent that the government's now choosing to target activists and organizers who are fighting against a white supremacist immigration system, well, frankly, I would expect nothing less from the United States government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree on that one.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very heavy, too, because when we're talking about this, and you had mentioned earlier about the, you know, these alerts placed on immigration lawyers' passports, all these things that would make it very hard, very difficult, if not impossible, for them to do what they've set out to do in terms of serving their clients. But there's also these things, these attacks that are directly linked to the efforts of the lawyers, the kinds of things that are being done, for instance, where one AOL director was detained in a cell with her 7-year-old daughter for quite some time. And that seems to be like this sort of rampant, this really vicious assault against anybody, and lawyers in particular, who are stepping up to stand with the immigrants.
That's now one of the most or more popularized or more prominent forms of government violence. I mean, you're talking about state-sanctioned violence against this movement. I mean, look everywhere, right? So everyone remembers the photos of the children in diapers being tear-gassed. Everyone remembers the photos of the mother having her child ripped away from her. Family detention, family separation. These are the sorts of things that the United States has and continues to impose upon anyone with any dissenting opinion. And I think when you look at the border more broadly and start to understand the context and history, then you'll start to see that the border has always been violent, or at least since the turn of the 20th century. And to the extent the media now is starting to pay attention to what goes on there, I think if you look more closely, it starts to unravel even further.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Angelo Guisado. Angelo is a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he's one of the people that's working on the situation of asylum seekers at the southern border of the U.S. At the same time, though, we're looking at this stuff from, I mean, clear across the border, as far as the border goes back and forth. There are these very vicious assaults on people, whether it's the Border Patrol actually breaking the water that's put out in the desert for people, or whether it's the kinds of attacks that have gone on. In fact, I just recently read where they, was it a day or so ago, that they opened fire with rubber bullets against a group of immigrants that were trying to actually get across. And that kind of thing, it's sort of like, on the one hand, there's the terrible oppression that's going down against the people, against the immigrants, and part of that repression and oppression is what's being done to the lawyers. And the lawyers play a very, very strategic part in the ability of these people to actually, quite frankly, for many of them, to stay alive.
It's totally true. I'm surprised I myself didn't end up on any government list. I very well may be by the end of this phone call. But I think your point's a good one, right? It's that the United States, through its Border Patrol, Border Protection, and ICE, is really instigating and completing its aim of instilling a white supremacist regime and an immigration system that's intended to harm people of color. I mean, just giving you some statistics here, you mentioned dumping water out. We all saw that from the Washington Post, retaliation against the group No More Deaths. Between 2012 and 2015, humanitarians recorded over 3,500 vandalized gallons of water. Imagine dumping out or slashing 3,500 gallons of water. Between 2000 and 2018, I think there were recorded more than 6,500 migrant deaths in the area. That's either from neglect of Border Patrol's search and response unit or out-and-out violence. I mean, we've seen more than 40 instances of CBP-related deaths. This is all part of the same system that's designed to deter individuals from coming, and even if they do come, get them out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the things that I was reading on, too, was this with, and it's concerning your client, El Otro Lado versus Nielsen, I guess it is. And it's a case that was filed last November around U.S. asylum policy. And it really looks at, you know, the case is built on the charge that the Customs and Border Protection, what a sort of Orwellian name, right? It's sort of, yes, we're the Customs and Border Protection.
Right.
And DHS are systematically violating international and U.S. law by denying the individuals the opportunity to apply for asylum. That's something that was really, I didn't realize that. And when I read that, it's a fairly important point.
I was working on this case 5 minutes before this show aired, right? So between the two cases, the El Otro Lado v. Nielsen case and the asylum ban, which relates to the denial of asylum for anyone who crosses in between ports of entry, the United States is actually effectively shuttering any means for getting into the asylum process. In the asylum ban case, they're saying anyone who doesn't apply for asylum at an official port of entry cannot apply for asylum under previous regulations. And with the Al Otro Lado case, they're saying anyone who actually goes to a port of entry has to get on an asylum wait list. And so it's sort of death by interminable delay. And so they've really got asylum seekers, migrants, and other people in a sort of horrendous catch-22 in which they're sort of marooned in these very dangerous Mexican border towns. And that we allege that violates federal law, international law, and the United States Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that actually that struck me, too, is I also read that all kinds of lies and threats were used to justify the whole approach they have and what they tell people about what they can or can't do. And it's really this pack of lies that have been packaged to make the people, one, very fearful, but two, to be obedient as they step back into the shadows.
I've been to at least 6 different ports of entry. I've talked to literally hundreds of individuals who have tried to apply for asylum and have been turned away. I'll tell you just 2 very brief stories. One, a group of LGBTQ individuals from Honduras applied 5 days in a row at the El Paso port of entry. Each day they were told, we're not taking Guatemalans today, specifically not Guatemalans, right? And so they had no choice but to cross in between ports of entry. And guess what happened? Of course, they were all prosecuted under Jeff Sessions' zero tolerance. The other story I'll tell you is we have a transgender client who was turned away multiple times at an official port of entry and was so scared in Tijuana that she was going to lose her life that she had to actually hop over one of the border fences. A Border Patrol agent saw this is 1 in the morning, and exasperated said, look, I'm going to have to bring you into custody. I don't want to. Please climb back over the fence into Mexico. Let's not make this difficult. And these 2 instances are probably not the only times that these exact same situations have happened.
Mm. You know, one thing, too, is that it's sort of it's all happening at a time when more and more people are desperately trying to escape all the terrible conditions and the violence against people in places like Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. It's sort of, you know, you think about all that. I was in TJ for a short period of time when the, you know, the people were coming up from Honduras, and it was just stunning to see the numbers of people and to hear the stories about what they had to try to live through and why they had to get out from where they were in order to stay alive. And then you look at this, what the system, what the U.S. is doing this in terms of this violence that's being being unleashed against people in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
And that's totally true. But one of the things I want your readers to pay attention to is why these Central American countries are so dangerous to begin with. And that's because of the United States' foreign policy in the late 70s and early 80s under Reagan and later under George H.W. Bush, you know, is that the United States decided to support right-wing groups, fascist organizations, paramilitary organizations, deferring to domestic corporate interests to expropriate land to destabilize these very countries, which cause, right, they have no jobs, they have a propagation of gangs, right? America deported tens of thousands of individuals back to El Salvador in the late 80s and early 90s, which led to the proliferation of the very gangs from which these individuals are fleeing. And so to fail to take into account the United States' role in destabilizing these countries to begin with is to do a real disservice to how we consider who these people are and whether they deserve to stay here, right? If the United States wants fewer refugees, they should stop creating so many.
Yeah, very, very good point. And one thing is the U.S. keeps encouraging and funding the Mexican government as well to increase their role in the detention and deportation of Central American asylum seekers, which is something I think a lot of people don't know at all.
Right. And, you know, I was hopeful that AMLO would come out with a more affirmative stance to protect migrants in this country. Now, he has done some good things. He has offered Central American individuals temporary work visas, which is more than previous administrations can say. That being said, I mean, I think Mexico is very clearly acquiescing in the Remain in Mexico policy. And if you look at what happened in Piedras Negras, in which they just threw hundreds of asylum seekers into an abandoned factory without food, water, or heat, conditions were in the 40 to 50 degree range, I think that they're certainly culpable too.
Yeah, you know, when I was there, it was very heavy because it was right after the big storms and all the stuff about the places that they were given to stay that had been shut down due to sanitation problems and just horrible places. And they moved people, you know, people were also having to go to the border every day to try and see if they could get their, you know, chance mm-hmm. to pass through. And instead, what the system did there in TJ, they moved all of the people that were actually out in the center of the city. They moved them really far away to this like former sort of concert hall, football field.
Former nightclub.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it was horrendous. I mean, you're looking at all these people, and then it's a huge trip to try and walk your way back down to the border from there. But at the same time, you had these trucks loaded with these military guys with their guns standing, just holding their guns out and pointing them, scanning the crowd with their guns. And they were all over the place like that. And I know at one point, a friend of mine was there, and she was like, gave somebody some literature, and she was followed to our car by the police, because they wanted to know what she gave, and it was just a very, very heavy scene. And I think that what happens to people there at the same time is that there's a lot of people who were really hoping that there would be some way they would get out. And then there's some people who are just like, okay, I'm just going to lay down and see what, I don't know what else to do. But then there were a lot of people who were also getting very, very angry about this. And I thought the spirit of people was growing, but I thought also the repression was growing just as much.
I'll make 2 points. One is that the government has insisted that asylum seekers have to get on the wait list. So there's an order to the system in which the government will process anywhere from 20 to 50 asylum seekers per day. That wait list is actually kept in a physical notebook that I've seen. Migrants themselves are the gatekeepers. They're the ones with the book, they're the ones with the pen, and it gets passed down from migrant to migrant. So the United States is actually relying on asylum seekers to organize themselves, and it's a fairly democratic process, but the United States has really clear international obligations under the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, and that certainly doesn't anticipate handing off or delegating this responsibility to the migrants themselves. The other point that I want to make is that the United States can put an end to this immediately, and it would be cheaper and more effective to do so. I once took an ICE detention tour, I think it was in November, and an ICE employee informed me that it was somewhere between $160 to $200 a day to detain a migrant going forward. I asked him, what are the other measures that they use? He says, well, sometimes we leave them unsupervised release, appoint them an attorney, and have regular check-ins. The other way is to give them an ankle bracelet. And I said, well, why wouldn't you give them supervised release all the time? He said, well, they don't always have an attorney. They don't always show up. When individuals are provided with attorney, they show up to court 96% of the time. When they're in a family, that's 99% of the time. He then told me that an ankle bracelet costs the United States government $4 per day. And I asked him again to repeat how much it costs to detain a migrant per day, and he said somewhere between $160 to $200. So the government's spending $156 per day that it doesn't have to. There's about 50,000 individuals in federal immigration custody today. None of them need to be there.
Mm-hmm. All right, Angelo Guisado, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take care. All right, that was Angelo Guisado, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he specializes in government misconduct, racial justice, and immigrants' rights issues. And we're on our way out of here, so I'm going to try and do this really fast. I really want to thank my engineer for today, Lisette Tapia, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we'll talk to you again next week.